training to fly near Washington, D.C.? I don't need that. Want to bet? I'm Paul Plagg, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Andy Cibula, who is AOPA's Executive Vice President of Government Affairs. A big story in the news a few days ago was that the FAA wants to impose new training requirements, not only on general aviation pilots who would fly through the Washington, D.C. Air Defense Identification Zone, but within 60 miles of the center of it. Andy, thanks for taking a few minutes out for our listeners today. If I understand correctly, there were a lot of people pushing for this thing.
Yeah, unfortunately, there has continued to be a lot of pressure on the FAA to take action that restricts pilots. So in many cases, it's not really that the FAA has a strong opinion, but they're essentially told what they need to go and implement. And everything that we've heard thus far, that's kind of been the case on this one.
I guess the thing that's tough for a lot of pilots to understand is that just becoming a pilot or just becoming an aircraft owner is a pretty rigorous vetting process in itself. I mean, unlike what some people who mean us harm can do with a car so easily, history says that it's tough to do these things with an airplane.
Yeah, and for us, you know, what we try to do is educate the policymakers on the reality of what a light aircraft is, you know, how much it weighs, the challenges associated with flying. But I tell you, when it comes to the Washington, D.C. area, there's no doubt that there's a strong interest by, I will call them, the security officials in restricting general aviation access.
I guess what the hard part I have about this is that everywhere we turn, we see headlines that make it look as if Homeland Security and TSA are attacking things that are conspicuous rather than things that are really a problem. I know when the Democratic Convention was going on in Denver, I actually found it a little bit encouraging that they were paying some attention to vehicular traffic and closing I-25 when Barack Obama was going to give his acceptance speech at Invesco Stadium. This one just looks like a persistent measure of looking like we're doing something about a problem that may or may not really exist.
Yeah, well, I guess for us, while we don't like it, we're really in a position where what we've tried to argue once we've argued against, you know, the whole AIDAs itself, is then trying to have some sense of reasonableness, or I'll call it practicality, probably with a small p, that enables pilots to at least know what's going on and keep themselves out of trouble. I mean, as a illustration of that, last year at the just about this time last year, the FAA implemented some changes to the AIDAs, which made it far easier to navigate, because rather than looking like Mickey Mouse, it became round, which certainly is easier to identify. But the good thing was that it also cut out 4 airports from being covered by the AIDAs, some special procedures at Leesburg that made it not as difficult to comply with. And then on top of that, the FAA also added some resources that gave pilots the service. Now, this training proposal and now final rule that the FAA has put out, it was really precipitated by a couple of pretty high-profile incursions into the AIDAs. And so there really wasn't any argument that people flying in the AIDAs need to understand the procedures. What we were saying back in 2006 when the proposal came out was, why do you require the training beyond those that are actually wanting to fly into the AIDAs? Because that kind of sets up a de facto, almost an AIDAs security training area. I mean, an example for us was somebody that's flying from Erie, Pennsylvania, down to Hagerstown, Maryland, which is, not in the AIDAs. How is that pilot going to necessarily know that the 60-mile training requirement exists? So it's they've set up a potential gotcha for pilots, and boy, you just hate to see that.
Well, it also sounds like they've taken away the option for a lot of pilots to kind of do ATC a favor and cancel IFR on the way into some of these airports.
Yeah, it was actually kind of interesting because one of the recommendations that we had made was that IFR not be included in the training requirement. So it's a little ironic that that actually adds just a little bit of complexity. But the point was is that somebody in that's on an IFR flight plan, they're already in contact with the air traffic control, and they're really under the direction of air traffic control as opposed to a VFR pilot. And so that was kind of the logic for that. It always seems like there's these unintended consequences that make it just a little bit frustrating for us and as aviators.
Well, now back in June when you guys had your open house at Frederick, you went to great lengths and a little bit of money to make sure that every pilot for quite a distance around that area had some warning if they were even seen walking toward their airplane on a ramp at a small airport. Was that something that was based on maybe seeing this thing coming?
Actually, back in fly-in, we had a really complex situation because the president was at Camp David that weekend. And so that meant that the airspace around the Camp David presidential retreat, which is fairly close to Frederick, Maryland, was expanded. And so we wanted to make sure that pilots were not going to inadvertently violate that airspace. But the other thing is, for just overall security purposes, I mean, we really have been an advocate since 9/11 about pilots being alert for suspicious activity and reporting it, which is one of the reasons that we launched the Airport Watch program. So our tagline on that is for pilots to lock up their aircraft and then look out and report any suspicious activity. So that's really an ongoing effort by the association.
Well, I just I wish that we could make our case better, but I guess when general aviation pilots continue to blunder through those areas, and obviously some people don't get briefings. I've been at a small air show where planes kept coming into land long after the airport was closed and it had been NOTAMed. So I guess in some ways we only have ourselves to blame for this. But let's talk briefly about the training options for people who do have to fly through this area, because while it's burdensome, it doesn't look like it's going to be difficult.
No, it's not. Really, what the FAA has done at this point is they've produced a course on flying through the ATIS that, quite frankly, it's pretty well done. The one thing about accessing the course that we've asked the FAA to change is that you have to go through a whole registration process for something called the FAST program, and we've asked that if they could allow pilots to access that training course without having to go through the whole registration procedure. But for right now, that's the course that's acceptable to the FAA, and pilots have to go through that by I think it's February 9th, if I'm remembering correctly, of next year.
Right. Well, but there is also an older course that many of our listeners may already have taken, called Navigating the DC-8IS, TFRs, and Special Use Airspace. How long ago, I mean, how far back does the computer save those course completion certificates so you could still download them?
That's a very good question. We right now are working through some of the details with the FAA on how pilots can comply. And so I know because we're getting a good bit of contact from the pilot community, and so for us, we want to make sure that looking ahead that the pilots can have what they need to do to prove it. And of course, you know, the irony of this is that you could be a pilot right now flying in the ATIS who's been in the ATIS ever since it was put into place, and you still have to go through a course. You could probably teach the course on how it really works.
Well, and it also notes that live safety seminars put on by the FAA safety program will qualify. Are any of those planned that you know of?
At this point, I don't have their schedule, but they conduct those on a pretty regular basis. So I think for pilots, it's going to be a matter of just watching out for the FAA scheduling those seminars. I would just think that the majority of pilots are going to be doing this online rather than going through a live course. That's certainly been our experience.
Yeah, sure. Especially with fuel prices where they are now. My guest is Andy Cibula, who is AOPA's Executive Vice President of Government Affairs. Andy, when we come back from the break, let's talk for just a moment about the beginning of the end for the VOR network across the country. I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Okay. Right up front, let me say that Garmin does not give tax advice. We have lawyers who cringe at the very thought of suggesting there might be tax advantages to buying a new Garmin avionics system this year.
Did he say tax advantages?
Could that be construed as tax advice, either express or implied?
Yeah, like I said, lawyers. So I guess I won't be telling you that this year Congress is offering special bonus depreciation up to 50% in year one for qualified business equipment placed in service during 2008. Business equipment like, say, a new Garmin avionics stack. But you didn't hear that from me, right?
What did he just say?
Okay, better check with your tax consultant for guidance and your Garmin dealer for the installation. Garmin. Follow the leader.
See your tax advisor for guidance.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with Andy Cibula, who is the Executive VP of Government Affairs for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. AOPA, Andy, has announced that it has found the FAA is planning to reduce the network of VHF omni-radial directional navigation stations across the country beginning in 2010. I think when we saw how great GPS was, we all kind of saw the writing on the wall for the VOR system eventually. How does AOPA feel about that particular point in time, though? 2010 is the beginning of the end.
Well, we've got some real concern about just how fast the FAA moves forward, because ultimately pilots are going to need some sort of a backup. We did a survey of the members, and 80% told us that they want a backup to GPS. And, of course, the VOR system that would be envisioned as a backup would not be anywhere near as extensive as the current system is. But there's some real questions about just how quickly the FAA is moving forward on this. I mean, we're all excited about GPS. We're excited about moving forward with ADS-B. But at the same time, whether it's to comply with the regulatory requirement as you go through recurrent training or initial training, there's also the practical nature that the GPS signal can, in fact, go down, or you might, in fact, you know, as a aircraft operator, have a problem with your GPS equipment.
Well, and I think it's been mentioned too that it's not particularly robust against someone who would intentionally do us harm. I know, I think it was AOPA that was arguing last year to keep Loran in place as a backup for GPS.
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate about what should be the backup to GPS. And our position on Loran has been, don't eliminate it as a potential backup. And so, and it takes literally, for federal government standards at least, it's just a couple of million dollars a year to keep it up and running. And so our argument has been, don't shut down the Loran system until we absolutely know what is going to be the backup for GPS in the future.
Well, it seems to me that we've got two separate kind of discussions going on in our heads here. One is what the backup will be. The other one is a timeline. Is there any sensitivity about asking the FAA to maintain a system that costs as much as VORs do in an environment where the FAA wants to find a new way to shift costs onto the GA community?
Yeah, there's always a sensitivity to that, but what we're talking about here is, kind of somewhat ironically, is really in many cases complying with their regulations And so, if, of course, they're asking us to comply with the regulations, you would hope that they're going to and expect that they're going to provide the means to meet the regulatory requirements. So that's one side of it. But, I mean, I'll use as an illustration, that's one of the reasons why you saw AOPA not opposing the outsourcing of the flight service station system, because here you had a system that was antiquated, in need of modernization, and a pretty expensive system. And by outsourcing that, although the FAA is still providing the service technically, they're doing it through contract, by doing that, they've reduced the cost to provide flight service station services to the general aviation community, but at the same time modernized the system. So those are the kinds of things that we're always alert to, is various opportunities. So there's no doubt that there will be fewer VORs in the future, but the question is really, you know, how quickly do you do that, and then just as an aviation community, what are we going to be looking at as the backup to GPS?
A lot of people were kind of scratching their heads, I think, when Phil Boyer announced that AOPA had succeeded in getting the FAA to put off full implementation of ADS-B until 2020, or at least the requirement for us to fly with it, because that, among other things, that puts the U.S., well, notably 8 years behind China in planned full implementation. Why is it desirable to push that deadline that far off into the future?
Well, with the problem with ADS-B for the majority of people in general aviation is it's really just going to be an additional cost to really fly what you're flying today. The FAA's proposed rule would still require you to have a MOD-C transponder. Under the ADS-B out proposal, to fly in the current airspace where a transponder is required, you're going to have to spend anywhere from $2,500 to another $5,000 just to do that. So there's not really any benefit for the pilot community. So, of course, you'd want to defer that expense as long as you can. And the FAA, even in dealing with the airlines, really hasn't proven to them on what is going to be the benefit of ADS-B to the aviation community. To the FAA, it would save them money, because they would not have to have as robust a system of radar. So what we're doing right now is we're in pretty extensive discussions through something called an aviation rulemaking committee that is really debating, now that the comments on the proposed rule have all come in, really debating what the FAA could do, what kind of changes they might make to implementing ADS-B. Some of those could mean that the scope of where ADS-B is required is dramatically reduced, or there could be things as creative as incentives for aircraft owners to not just meet the compliance of the proposed rule, which would be just ADS-B out, which is, again, really just kind of like a transponder of today, but to actually be able to get the equipment to have ADS-B in, where you are getting weather and traffic and the other kind of information that could be very useful to a pilot.
Well, I think the only thing I can predict with a fair amount of security going into the future is that we're probably going to have to spend more on a regular basis to keep up with technology, because as big a leap as it has taken with ADS-B, what's going to happen even by the time ADS-B gets implemented? I mean, we're kind of in the same situation that any government bureaucracy finds itself, and that is that the organization can't turn as quickly as technology comes on the horizon.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any question ADS-B will be implemented. I think the big question is, for all of the users, and this just really is not just general aviation, what kind of additional benefits can the FAA provide? So for the airlines, let's say, what they really want is they want reduced separation that would allow them to fly more aircraft into the airspace, and then hopefully potentially into an airport. although you still got the concrete as being a huge governor on that on that access point.
Right.
But I don't think there's any doubt that we know we're going to be moving to ADS-B. I think that it really is just a question of exactly how we as a community do it. And the proposed rule FAA put out there, it was a good starting point for the discussion, for the negotiation, and it was a serious starting point. And that's why the work of that committee right now is so serious. And the hope is that certainly before the end of the year that they'll have made their formal recommendations to the FAA, and then the FAA will take what will likely be then the next step in putting out either a revised proposed rule or a final rule that is different from what they actually proposed last year.
Well, Andy, I want to close by saying that as an AOPA member, I appreciate what you guys do for my $40 a year. And it's pretty remarkable what the organization has been able to accomplish and the profile it has achieved, you know, in dealing with the government as well. And I know you've got an interesting but difficult job, and we wish you all encouragement in keeping it up. I know that's going to be kind of an interesting season when we get past the presidential elections. You guys will have a lot to think about.
Oh, we will, and thank you very much. We very much appreciate every member's support.
Andy Sabula is the Executive Vice President for Government Affairs for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. You can find out more about AOPA at aopa.org. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.